Occhio destro dominante.
Right eye dominant.
Rechtes Auge dominant.
Right eye dominant.
Høyre øye dominant.
Right eye dominant.
Align the lumna almuhaimina to.
Right eye dominant.
This is the Right Eye Dominant podcast.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Right Eye Dominant podcast. I'm your host, Nick Toro Jr. This is the first episode of 2024, so Happy New Year. Welcome back to Season 3 of the Right Eye Dominant podcast. And as I planned for this season, I wanted to expand the topics just a little bit away from just straight photography talk, and also cover some topics that were just at least tangentially attached to the world of photography. And today's episode is evidence of that widening scope. Today I'll be talking about the work and the life of Ray Johnson. Ray Johnson was a visual artist who was living and creating work in New York during the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, and he was also just sort of a enigmatic figure on the scene. I've even heard him referred to as the most famous unknown artist in New York. He definitely ran in circles of much more successful, much more well-known artists, and Ray, for one reason or another, never really achieved the level of notoriety or success that some of his peers did. However, what I find fascinating about Ray Johnson is that he created work and distributed it in lots of unconventional ways, specifically using the U.S. Postal Service to distribute his artwork in a method of sharing art via postcards. And that really appealed to me, as I've actually done a little bit of that myself. And any way that you can get your art to people without using the traditional gallery or museum path, I'm just fascinated by that. I also realized that Ray's whole life is sort of shrouded in different levels of mystery, and I wanted to get more clarification on who he was and what he did with his artwork and what his life was really all about. So I reached out to the Ray Johnson estate. They put me in touch with today's guest. Her name is Ellen Levy, and she is the author of a forthcoming book all about Ray Johnson, and it's entitled A Book About Ray. So a perfect person to talk to about this great sort of mysterious figure in the art world. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Ellen Levy, all about the life and work of the enigmatic Ray Johnson. So welcome to the Right Eye Dominant podcast, Ellen Levy.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
I reached out, we got connected via, I reached out to the Ray Johnson estate and they connected me with you. And I'm so grateful that you could take the time to discuss the life and work of Ray Johnson with me. Before we jump into any of that, I would just love for you to just to fill in me and my audience on a little bit of your own, you know, who you are and how you ended up being so knowledgeable about Ray and his work.
Well, I am an English professor and my specialty is poetry, especially 20th century poetry. So you wouldn't think I would be a specialist in Ray Johnson. Although my subspecialty is the crossover between poetry and visual art. And that's how I got to Ray Johnson. My first book was about it was focused on three artists. It was about Marianne Moore, Joseph Cornell, and John Ashbery. And I went to a show at Richard Feigen Gallery, which is where the Ray Johnson estate was originally housed. And they did shows of Ray Johnson's work after his death. And I went to one of those and I realized that Ray Johnson, I knew about him from How to Draw a Bunny, but I'd never seen the work. And it was the first time I saw the work and I really fell in love with it. And also I realized he was as obsessed with both Joseph Cornell and Marianne Moore as I was. So I thought, maybe I'll write a chapter about him. But then as I dove in, I realized there's too much there and I've got to finish the book. So I did a talk about him another couple years later and went to the estate to research. And then I just thought, why don't more people know who this guy is? This guy is an amazing artist and not like anyone else. I just kept thinking about him for a couple of years. The estate published the essay I wrote then as a little catalog. And I went back to the estate a few years later and said, would you be interested in my writing a biography of Ray Johnson? Because I knew I needed their backing to do anything about him because they have permission for all the work. And I got started on it. And that was about 8 years ago. And my book is finally finished and will be out next fall. It's called A Book About Ray, and it will be out from MIT Press.
Great.
So yeah, that's the whole story.
Yeah. So what I find interesting, just a couple of sort of twisted kind of tangents off of what you were just saying. So my own awareness of Ray Johnson, also I had seen the movie How to Draw a Bunny, and it's funny because I don't even think like that movie was necessarily promoted in a way that, like, I was still surprised after I saw that film of how not only important his work or intriguing his work was, but also the art world that he navigated. I was just very surprised by sort of like, oh, here's a, maybe in the same way you were, like, how come more people don't know about this guy? The other thing that was attractive to me, and one of the things I do want to sort of at least have some of our discussion focus on, is his use of the Postal Service. I say mail art, and then some people think it's M-A-L-E. So I try to specify mail, postal art. But using the U.S. mail, the Postal Service, to as a component of his work, I've always been intrigued by that idea even before I knew about Ray and his work, and have since... And this is, again, I know I'm babbling and I will edit myself.
No.
But there is a International Union of Mail Artists that has a website online, which I recently joined up and have this interchange of just like sending postcards and mail art across the world. And Ray Johnson is like the patron saint of that group. So the sort of the relevance of his work to me has been growing, and hence my curiosity to explore this further with you. So it sounds like we both kind of just sort of stumbled upon this almost like treasure chest of creativity.
Well, I think that's true for a lot of people. And I think How to Draw a Bunny, which is now a big classroom film, I have a lot of students who've seen it in high school or early college classes. So that's the way people get to him. But it's not surprising that one has to stumble on him, because, as you know, at this point, he had a public presence for about 15 years of his art life. You know, he really only showed in galleries for 13 years. Mm. It took him a long time to get to galleries. About 10, he was producing after he went to Black Mountain College, with everybody one has ever heard of. And then he went to New York and he had this cult following. But for various reasons, he didn't have a gallery show till he was in his 30s. And then he withdrew from the gallery scene about 13 years later. Mm. And for the last 15 years of his life, he didn't show in commercial venues at all. And he barely showed anywhere else. He had one museum show in his entire career, and that was in a museum in Long Island. And he just made it very difficult for people to show the work. He was beloved by curators and museum people in some ways, but, you know, he began to just say to them, "You don't want to work with me. I'm going to drive you crazy. Mm. I'm going to make you cry." I mean, I've heard people have told me this.
Yeah.
And so for the last 15 years of his life, he was practically invisible. So if you didn't already know who he was, you didn't know who he was.
This doesn't have to be like a long discussion or exploration, but you did mention Black Mountain College and that obviously being an epicenter of creativity for American art in general. Do you have any information or insight into like how he even ended up going there? Can we talk a little bit about that?
I can tell you that story. So Ray Johnson thought of himself as an artist from pretty early on. And he was flagged by it. There's a school in Detroit, which is also where I'm from and where he's from, called Cass Technical High School. It was the first selective public prep school in Detroit. And it focused on sort of things the auto industry needed, including art, with an emphasis on commercial art, but it had a really strong visual art program. And Ray Johnson went there. So he went to an arts high school and took lots of art classes, including commercial art classes. And he went to art camp. He went to this famous art camp in Western Michigan. And there he met a young woman named Elaine Schmidt. And she had a sister who was already at Black Mountain. And Elaine was friends with Ruth Asawa, the sculptor, future sculptor from back home in Milwaukee. And the sister, Betty, got together with Ruth Asawa and Elaine and Ray Johnson and said, "You have to come to Black Mountain. It's so great." And that's how he got there. So it was through a kind of, already he was on an art circuit.
Yeah.
And yeah, so that's how he got to Black Mountain.
One of the things that I kind of confounded by with Ray and his at least artistic career, or I mean, if you want to use that term, I guess you could, is that here's a guy, obviously aesthetically minded, creative person, obviously at a young age, goes to Black Mountain, is surrounded by other sort of movers and shakers of sort of the artistic scene in the country at that time, and makes his way to New York. I don't know if it was directly, he was directly goes
about
to New York.
About 2 years after Black Mountain. Yeah.
Which all makes sense from, I mean, you know, obviously New York being, you know, the center of the art world at that time. So sounds like to me a logical path to being an artist. Yet it seems like, and like you described, either willingly or unwillingly,
both.
And I want to talk about that. His life as an artist in New York specifically, but his life in the art world, dealing with collectors or curators or being shown, is very complicated. And so,
yeah, it is. And as you say, he started on a totally normal path. You know, he came with all his Black Mountain friends, a lot of whom would become famous, to New York. And he aimed to be a painter, and he had a studio because he fell in love with an older man who was teaching at Black Mountain, Richard Lippold, who was in the mid-century a very famous sculptor, and who was one of John Cage's best friends. Mm. So John Cage and Merce Cunningham and Lippold and Ray Johnson and Morton Feldman all lived in this building downtown where they had their studios. And Ray would paint and paint and paint. And he painted in sort of the mode of Josef Albers, who was his most important teacher at Black Mountain. And, you know, geometric abstraction, very beautiful, very meticulous, what's left of it. But he just, at a certain point in the mid-50s, late 50s, he tried to destroy all of his paintings and managed to destroy almost all of his paintings.
Can I jump in there? Was it not unknown kind of idea for an artist to do that?
Right.
Like John Baldessari actually making that an artistic statement, for example. But what, like, do you know why he?
Yeah, I do. By then he had started to do collage. He'd started to do, you know, I think you know about the Modico's situation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We could talk about that. But he had started basically to do a lot of collage, and he had started to do the mail art. Mm-hmm. It wasn't called, the New York Correspondence School wasn't named yet, but he had started to send his friends these little collages and these funny mixes of letters and objects and clippings, and they'd open an envelope and have no idea what they'd get. And at first it was just kind of a fun thing among friends, and then it started to get to be a thing. And in 1958, he started doing the sort of chain letterish thing where he'd write, please send to, mm-hmm. on the mail. And they were supposed to be sent along paths to one person, to another person, to another person. And eventually sometimes get back to Ray, sometimes stop somewhere along the route. And this was the beginning of, and this is why Ray Johnson seems to be having resurgence. Now, this is the beginning of what we call social media.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's because it's not just sending a piece of art to another person, a decorated letter. The idea becomes more and more a kind of system of communication among a network of people who are aware of one another, but don't necessarily personally know one another.
Mm.
And that really, Ray gets that, he begins to get that idea on his own somewhere between 1955 and 58. And in 58, he launches this network idea.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, like, that's something I didn't really think about as I've been learning more about him. And that aspect of pre-social media exercise of sharing and controlling, or not necessarily controlling, but
semi-controlling,
or at least using an unexpected channel to share his own thoughts and visions with other people, and not in an anonymous way, not in a sort of like I'm going to point my finger in the phone book and then send it to that address. There's obviously, which may be an interesting exercise in and of itself, but there was clearly an approach in his mind that he was formulating and then executing on.
Yeah, it began by sending things to his friends, many of whom were already artists or writers or creative people in some way, and also to curators. There's a kind of publicity aspect to it, as there is in social media. He sent very, in 1955, he was already sending things to like curators at the Museum of Modern Art who didn't know him from Adam.
Mm-hmm.
He just like send this stuff.
Right.
But he didn't approach them conventionally as an artist. He would just send them these bizarre things.
And I'm trying to kind of envision what the art world was like at that time. To me, it seems like it was a much smaller world.
It just was smaller. You could, everyone says, and that you could do all the gallery openings in a day in New York. I mean, you could get to all the galleries in a day or two. The scene was just much smaller and of course much cheaper.
Sure. Yeah. Of course.
You could be a starving artist because, I mean, Ray's rent on the Lower East Side was $30.
Wow.
Which even then wasn't that much.
Yeah. So that being said, people knew who he was, right? I mean, if they were
everybody on the scene knew who he was, but he wasn't showing in galleries. And he wasn't showing in museums. He kind of wanted to, but he kind of didn't want to. And again, there's this moment when he destroys the paintings, which were the surest route to getting shown in galleries and museums, and focusing on this stuff that was unshowable.
Mm-hmm.
The mail art was not designed to be shown, and it was not designed to be sold. If anyone in his mail art network was known to sell things, they were excommunicated. So he actually looked at this stuff again between like late 50s, early 60s, and he thought, this may not get me into galleries and museums, but it's more interesting to me than painting because it's something else.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, of course, you know, the painting is over moment is happening in a lot of people's heads. This is, he's a peer and friend of Rauschenberg and Johns and Warhol, who are all working their way out of painting in a conventional sense. But he's really, he's working his way off the canvas completely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems in some ways, as you said, the sort of the connection to sort of like early social media, he was ahead of his time in a lot of ways. So the idea then, making an intentional break from his earlier work, going the path that he's going with the new collage work and the mail art, and having it be not intended for a traditional gallery environment. What's the roots of that for him? So here, and maybe I'm going to have to talk around this to maybe get to the question. Everything that, like, this path that he's taken, as I said, seems like a logical sort of progression to where he is. The rejection of the traditional sort of being shown in a gallery, and some of it is intentional. Some of that work probably, even if he was trying really hard to get it shown, was a hard sell, I'm sure, at that time. But what is, where is the intention, like this counter, anti sort of gallery stance come from?
Well, that question has different valences. One of them, you could say, who is he thinking of? And one person I think he's thinking of a lot is Kurt Schwitters, who also, you know, started out as a painter, ended up with a really funny career,
mm-hmm.
that, like Ray Johnson's, went between. Also, a thing to say is that Ray Johnson was a very talented graphic artist, and he was doing graphic art to make money while he was doing these things. And then the graphic art feeds into the mail practice. Eventually, as he starts to do more Xerox work, his talent as a graphic artist becomes part of his work as a fine artist, as he moves out of graphic art as a commercial practice. Anyway, so Kurt Schwitters did that too. Kurt Schwitters was a graphic artist, a commercial artist, a collage artist, a performance artist. And that kind of career is something Ray had his eye on.
Mm.
How he got to, I mean, why is still a big question. Why he rejected a traditional career is still a huge question.
Well,
he just found this interesting. He found it more challenging and more interesting.
And to me, you don't have to necessarily justify the why, because you know, I mean, if we're looking at what, like, why does one create? Why does one write or paint or photograph anything? The motivations, and keeping that separate from any sort of monetary, commercialized sort of exchange or putting a value to it, seems to me that, like, almost, I think the reason why I'm asking is because he's almost like an anomaly. And even in, like, today's world, like, people are monetizing their social media presence. Anyone's looking for a way to, you know, like, well, what's the monetary value of what you're doing? So I think seeing somebody who, to whatever extent they did that, moves away from it. It's not like, well, what was wrong with the guy? Why didn't he want to make a buck?
Yeah.
You know, it's.
But it's more like, why didn't he want to show it? I mean, he did want to show it and he didn't want to show it. It's more the sort of the recognition thing than the money thing that I find surprising. He really was pretty amazing about the money. It was never, ever about the money. He never needed money. I mean, there was a time when he was like starving artists, but they were all starving artists at that time. So that didn't seem so weird. I was asked to review for a press, a volume of Joe Brainard's letters, and Joe Brainard there are letters from his early 20s where he is trying to stretch out what he calls potato chip dinners.
Wow.
And, yeah. You know, the starve, if you were, I've read John Ashbery's letters, and John Ashbery was often starving and hoping someone would take him out for a drink so he could get a little bit of something in his stomach. You know,
yeah.
People, they're devoted artists who do that. But Ray did it his whole life, and the money he never minded. He was deeply ambivalent about the recognition. He really wanted recognition, and he really fought against the kinds of exhibition and publicity that would get you recognition. So that, for me, is the real, the deep, lifelong internal paradox with Ray.
Yes.
Who really doesn't want recognition on some level?
Yeah, of course.
So I also find it really interesting. There seems to be like this trope or an expectation of like an outsider artist who's either naive or uneducated or struggling mentally. Yet here is a guy who clearly he's well-educated, has gone to very good art schools, has surrounded himself with very intelligent, creative people, and yet in some way has sort of still veered away from sort of taking the expected route. I mean, it's clear that this guy is he knows what he's doing, and he's clearly an intelligent person.
He was so smart. I mean, he was brilliantly intelligent. And he was in control, I think, of in the work, completely aware of globally what he was doing. And there were many moving parts to his work, so that awareness required a lot of mental energy. He knew how everything related to everything in all his different levels of practice. And he was aware of he was a real artist. He was conscious of the aesthetic problems that were generated by each successive phase of work. And he intensely worked through those aesthetic problems. I know you're interested in his late photography project. Mm-hmm. And I think when you look at that project, you can see a whole lifetime of working through of aesthetic problems sort of expressed in that project in various ways. But the compulsive difficulty that he presented to people, there was this weird mix of consciousness and feeding it into the art and helplessness about you know, just not being able to do things the way you were supposed to do things, not being able to talk the talk and walk the walk in the art world, while being as or more conscious than anyone who's ever lived of how things work in the art world. There was no naivete there, God knows.
Mm-hmm.
He knew exactly what you would have had to do had you done it.
Right, right. Well, you just mentioned it, and one of the things I was curious about was his later photographic work. And I'll just sort of, the way I heard about it, there was, I guess, maybe with 6 months ago, the New York Times ran a story and shared a bunch of images of Ray's. And from what I understand, he used a cheap disposable camera and was placing his work in, almost making like site-specific collages and then documenting it with the camera. Can we talk a little bit about just that work in general and what his process was?
Yeah, we certainly can. And in this, I rely on Joel Smith, who is the photography curator at the Morgan Library and Museum, who did this show on, you read about it in the Times, because there was a show at the Morgan of these photographs, which had never been shown before. And in fact, no one had really, even at the estate, they knew they were there before. And the only person who had ever talked to me about them before was John Walter, who directed How to Draw a Bunny. I interviewed John and got to know him, and he said to me, nobody has dealt with these photos. This is the part of Ray's production that somebody needs to do something about. And Joel Smith finally somehow got into this. And he and his assistants went through, and I think, if I remember correctly, Ray went through 137 quick snap cameras. And he was not a professional photographer, and he would just take them to the local photo place and have them develop. They're really crappy quality photos. Mm-hmm. I mean, in terms of focus and sharpness and all that. But they are, like, I think almost all of his work, all of his work involves an element of performance. Even when you can't see the performance from the very beginning, just to go back, and this is related to the late photography thing, that when he started doing collage, he did these small sort of, you can hold them in one hand, collages. They're the biggest ones are, you know, 12, 18 inches tall. They're not big. But there are these, he made hundreds and hundreds of these small collages, and he called them modicos, which is an anagram of osmotic, which he got while in conversation with his friend Norman Solomon, who was himself a very terrific photographer. And did amazing photography of the New York scene of that time with all the artists, another Black Mountain person. Anyway, he called them modicos, and he would do these kind of performances with them where he would set them up on the street in ranks or in some artist's studio. He did this with Ad Reinhardt at one point, who he was a studio assistant for. And he would ask people questions about the modicos. He'd stop people on the street and say, what is a modicos? Would you like modicos? He had this whole series of interview questions, and he would kind of dance with them a bit. And there's one record of this. His friend Susie Gavlik, who at the time was an artist but became better known as a critic, another Black Mountain circuit person. She had a friend named Elizabeth Novick, who later on became, in fact, a quite well-known fashion photographer, but was still young and not a professional photographer yet, and came down. Elizabeth Novick came to the Lower East Side where Johnson lived, and he and Susie Gavlik played around with the photos, with the modicos on the street. And Elizabeth Novick took this very beautiful series of photographs of them that were published in a magazine later, with an essay by Susie Gavlik. And it was an essay, a small magazine, edited by Tom Hess, who was later the editor of Art News, and the critic Harold Rosenberg. And so a substantial place. Mm-hmm. And these became a kind of legend thing. These photos of the modicos performance became part of Johnson's legend, and they fed into his mail art. He became obsessed with the idea of ephemerality, of art as something that is a gesture that is going to disappear, and yet with the idea of photography as a kind of stop along that way. And this marked his entire production throughout his life. But at the end, when he was really kind of totally withdrawn from the art world, he started, as you said, he took these quick snap photos, and he made collages specifically for the quick snap photos that were bigger than they were more sort of like large. I think of them as puppets, even though they're flat. Mm-hmm. And they're readable in these rather blurry photographs. And he made hundreds of those too. And he would take them out in Long Island where he lived and set them up in these funny little nowhere places. Playgrounds, graveyards, you know, backyards, ends of streets. And he would photograph them as a kind of performance.
Yeah.
He called them move stars, and he called the performances moves, because he could just move them around in his Volkswagen.
Hmm. Interesting. My curiosity about them was not necessarily from a photographic, like you just described. I mean, the fact that he was using 137, these sort of disposable cameras, very immediate documentation, lo-fi, but, easily accessible, probably bought them at the same drugstore that he went and got the prints made at. Again, immediately to my mind connects with a social media component, like an Instagram, you know, I mean, there's so many.
Yeah.
So many direct correlations between Ray and his work and what the world we live in now. And you're bringing up something also that I think is just maybe also probably became an important component for performance art happenings. What, you know, as that, you know, even I know Rauschenberg was
performing a lot.
And so a documentation of an event or an installation, the ephemerality of it, as you said, is sort of like this, you know, the documentation of it ends up being the key component, because if it's, you know, once it's happened and then it's not there anymore, and it's almost like he's flipping that idea on his head, on its head, because as you said earlier, like there were outside people who just happened to, you know, document an earlier placement of his art, but he's doing it himself. It's like this self-contained process start to, not like making an announcement saying like Ray Johnson will be installing his Modicos at this date and having some film crew or, you know,
no one saw these. No one saw him doing this.
So he would set them up, photograph them, break them down, and move on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interesting.
And every now and then there'd be a passerby. There are occasionally a friend of his or some passerby shows up in the photos, but sometimes he's in the photos, but there were no audiences for them. I mean, it's a question of what he would have done with them, because he died. He started this project in the early 90s. And he, as you know, and as everyone who's seen How to Draw a Bunny knows, he killed himself in early 95. And so these were his last project, and he had begun to work them into collages too. But he hadn't sent them to many people. He sent them to a handful of friends. He didn't say Xerox them and send them to a million of his male art network people the way he did with other things. Mm. They weren't circulated. They weren't shown in galleries. They weren't, you know, there were no, he used to do performances at museums and colleges and things. They were never used in those. They were in a theater, but in a theater without an audience. Which was sort of an image he was obsessed with at that time. This like little theater thing appears in about half of his collages of that time. So the idea of a theater, but a theater for no one.
Hmm. That's poetic. And one of my, I think, sort of end of the conversation questions would be, imagine if he were alive today, what we have at our disposal now with the technology, internet, distribution of information. And I know we're
but everyone wonders about this, because he was only 67 when he died, which is not young, but not super old. Mm-mm. And he wasn't sick, and he was still quick-minded and making beautiful art. And this was 95. What if he had lived another 5, 6, 7, 8 years? What would he have done with that? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, he would have been pretty old once the Instagram business started. Still, God knows. I mean, you know, what he did with mail was ahead of what mail could do. What he did with the quick snaps, as you say, was already Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
What he would have done with early social media and then early, you know, visual social media, he would have shown us whatever is coming down the pike. He would have shown us what we'll see in 10 years.
Mm.
He would have done something with that was twisted it forward in time.
Yeah,
is my belief.
Yeah. I think so too. To circle back to that original sort of thought then. In a lot of ways, he was ahead of his time, or we're just catching up, you know, like that. It does make sense. And, you know, like, I almost feel like I forget what the term is called, but it's like you buy a yellow Honda and then all of a sudden you start seeing yellow Hondas everywhere before you hadn't seen them. There's a certain effect for that. And I'll have to dig that up. But the more my own personal curiosity about Ray Johnson has grown, it almost seems like he's kind of like everywhere more often now. But I think part of that is, to your point, your earlier point, it's that he presaged so much of this, the things that we're living in, sort of the future that he was sort of showing us or showing people. And
I mean, another aspect of that is that the digitalization of everything means that the idea of a dematerialized art is not strange at all.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, older people that I talk to from the art world are still, Ray Johnson. That wasn't, you know, it wasn't like Jasper Johns. Not that I don't love Jasper Johns, but younger people don't think the art has to be this precious, dense thing. The idea of art that's spread all over and hard to follow and that may disappear,
mm-hmm.
that's not weird to people under 40 now.
That's their reality.
That's their reality. And so when they encounter Ray Johnson, he feels fresh, both fresh and familiar to them. There were two biggish Johnson. I mean, the one at the Morgan was small but beautiful. And there was a bigger show at the Art Institute of Chicago 2 years ago, too, because they just acquired one of the two major archives of Ray Johnson materials. And they did a show out of that. And I went, obviously, to both. And when I went to both, each time I went, it was full of young people. It was full of people 35 and under.
Mm.
And that, you know, that's who I think if he acquires the reputation, I, of course, think he deserves, it's going to be this generation that makes that reputation.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would think that his reputation will only continue to grow just based on all of the things that you're pointing out there. It's almost like digging through and finding this evidence of sort of this, you know, not unknown quantity but this sort of, you know, uncovering this mystery, somebody who was part of, you know, maybe overlooked, but part of, you know, a very well-known, well-connected scene. Yet here is this, not only that the work, because I think of like Vivian Meyer, like the digging out of the, you know, just sort of like having this unknown lifetime of expression. That's not Ray Johnson. However, this sort of going back and this discovery of and this, I think, like you said, the younger generation seeing the value in it, and he, you know, maybe he'll continue to get more of the recognition that obviously you know that he deserves, and I'm learning more and more every day about that. So I think it's maybe a good time to be a fan of his for sure. You mentioned the archives, and the photos seem to have kind of like sprung up out of like maybe like an unknown sort of angle of his work. Is there other, like, is there, I mean, is everything that he's made known about now, or?
Never. No one is ever going to see it all. No one is ever going to see it all. This was a terrifying thing about doing this book. It's everywhere because the guy never slept, and he sent out a million pieces of mail a day. And he made lots of collages, which they're beautiful. And well, anyway, but part that the archival thing is actually going to help bring his reputation out too, I think, because the fact that Chicago has this major archive, which was collected by Ray's close friend, William S. Wilson, from the time they were in their 20s.
Mm.
Wilson was an English professor, and he just decided that Ray Johnson was it, and decided he would be his archivist, starting when they met when they were in their 20s. And Bill collected enormous amounts of material, not just directly through Ray, but through their circle of friends, including a lot of the Black Mountain people. And that's all at Chicago now. And once people start digging into that, it will be available to a wider public. And that's a thing. And the Morgan has just acquired the archive of the photographs. So the availability of these archives, also archive as art, again, is a new thing, relatively new thing. It's a thing of the last 20 years. And that, too, people are figuring out how to exhibit archives. And once those curators get a hold of the Ray Johnson materials, it will be a different deal. But there are archives. Oh, God, there are so many archives. And some of them are in places like the Getty and MoMA, and some of them are in people's garages.
Mm.
I never talked to anyone who didn't say, oh, would you like to see my boxes of Ray's?
Wow.
And there was stuff and more stuff, and each person had different stuff made just for them. It was really amazing.
Wonderful. Well, that means for those of us who are curious that there'll be, there's treasures just waiting to be seen. And hopefully an audience that continues to grow to appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Great. Well, I think that's a nice place for us to wrap up then. Ellen Levy, thank you so much for taking time out and teaching me a lot I didn't know about Ray Johnson. Hopefully my audience enjoys it as much as I did.
Thanks, Nick. That was a lot of fun.
Thank you so much. So there you go, folks. My conversation with Ellen Levy, all about the life and artwork of Ray Johnson. Just want to say that Ellen's book, A Book About Ray, is due out in August of 2024. So definitely keep an eye out for that. I hope you are intrigued and curious and want to learn more about Ray and his work. I will definitely share links to many of the projects that we discussed in the interview. And specifically, I would recommend tracking down the documentary film. It's titled How to Draw a Bunny. That's actually the first time I had ever heard of Ray and his work. And it's a really good sort of entry point into this self-created world of this enigmatic artist who was ahead of his time in many ways. And I just am still fascinated. All of the new discovery of his work that just keeps kind of coming out of his estate is just it's just a treasure trove. And I hope you get interested enough and dig into it as much as I have been, because it's really fascinating. That's going to do it for today's episode. I will, as I always do, ask you if you could just leave a rating or a review, hopefully at the Apple podcast platform. That seems to be the place where most people are listening to this. But also, if you could, you like this podcast and you know someone who might also like it, go ahead and share it with them. The audience growth has been really fantastic and really gratifying for me this season, and just want this thing to just keep going. So I appreciate everyone who listens and all of your support. Also, of course, if you want to go and find all old episodes, you can go to righteyedominantpodcast.com. They're all there for your easy access. And also, if you scroll down way down to the bottom of the page, you can leave me a question or a comment. And I always enjoy hearing from all the folks out there listening. So that's going to do it for today's episode. This has been the Right Eye Dominant Podcast. I've been your host, Nick Toro Jr. And until next time, stay well.
This podcast has been a production of righteyedominant.art. The music for today's episode is brought to you by The Comet Project and Yazar.